In May of 1964, President Lyndon Johnson outlined his goals for America to become a great society in this historic speech at the University of Michigan.
For in your time, we have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the great society.
Add Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal to Johnson's Great Society, and the 20th century was surely the era when America's government grew to become the powerful and complex entity that we see now. So what was the national government like in the 19th century? I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later on today's show,
the United States seemed to be spending an awful lot of money on these social programs, and yet poverty really wasn't going down much at all, and if anything, inequality was getting worse.
But first, in this era of government bailouts and town hall meetings over health care reform, it's clear many Americans oppose continued growth of the federal government, preferring it to be smaller and less intrusive, the way it was in the 19th century. Or was it? Historian Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia is my first guest today. He's written a new book about the U.S. government in the 19th century, in which he argues that Americans have always looked for a powerful and effective national government. He says we just don't want a big bureaucracy. So, Brian, the title of your book is A Government Out of Sight. And that phrase comes from where?
That comes from Alexander Hamilton. And Hamilton was warning us that a government out of sight would not be respected. Hamilton's notion of governance was very much from the European model. Governments needed to be powerful. They needed to have gendarmes. They needed to have visible symbols of their power so that people would fear them. Where Hamilton got it wrong, and don't get me wrong, Hamilton's a brilliant guy, but where he really misunderstood how American politics would play out is that government turned out to be most powerful when it was least visible, when it operated through tax subsidies, when it operated through third parties, when it operated through the legal system without creating big bureaucracies and those kinds of gendarmes and visible military that Hamilton so much wanted.
Did early ordinary Americans really care one way or another what our national government was or wasn't?
They cared intensely. I mean, they were terrified. I mean, well, first of all, let's go to the granddaddy of them all, the Civil War. Southerners felt quite strongly about the ability of the Union to tell them whether slavery could expand into those territories out west. But on a far more day-to-day basis, people felt intensely that they themselves needed to be in charge and that local officials were accountable. You know, if it remained in the county, if it remained in the locality, they could hold that official accountable. And that official shouldn't be trusted. We're talking for much of the 19th century. And the reason that the national government was so distrusted is you couldn't keep an eye on those folks in eventually Washington, D.C. They were far away. They were distant. And the great fear throughout American history is the creation of all of these functionaries, all of these bureaucrats, the kind of people that were over in America doing the bidding of King George, which led to the American Revolution.
So let's start to look at the difference between the 19th and the 20th century. You say the myth is that America's national government grew tremendously during the 20th century out of almost nowhere. But that's true, right? The actual size of the government did grow tremendously in the 20th century.
The reason we think the national government didn't do anything in the 19th century is that these days we measure the government's power by the number of personnel and by the size of the budget. And by any of those standards, the government grew tremendously in the 20th century.
To illustrate just how small it was, you write in your book about a Frenchman who came to the War Department and commented on what he saw.
Yeah, well, he was looking for the secretary, and he asked to see him, and he was told, oh, he's next door getting a haircut. I said, well, who else is here? And, you know, the man in census said, you're looking at the rest of the department. If you were looking at government by the size of the budget compared to GMP or personnel, you would not see that much growth between the end of the 18th century and the Civil War. Yet, the country expanded, and two keys to that: a national military that helped to secure the land by fighting Indians and then eventually clearing Indians, and a national government that ran territories until they were ready to enter as states. And those territories were governed initially directly from Washington, D.C. And, you know, if I had to say, why did the authority of the national government grow for much of the 19th century, it was to promote economic development. It is true, the national government was not providing national health care, but the welfare of the people was being subsidized by the growth of the power of the national government because it was helping sustain this national or create a national economy. How else did they do this? They did this through internal improvements, building roads, building canals, and then eventually subsidizing railroads. Do you know there were a lot of people who lived in North Carolina, Kentucky? They were good Americans in that they subscribed to the principles inscribed in the Constitution. But as one man said on the Carolina frontier, no matter how much we want to be a good American, if we can't ship our goods to market, we're going to become Spaniards. And there was a constant tension between economically integrating these folks on this ever-moving frontier and their political allegiance to the United States.
What was happening out west during this period in terms of government influences?
Well, out west, the national government is doing a lot of surveying. It's fighting the Indians and making this land safe for white settlers to move out there. And by the end of the 19th century, this is when the national government really becomes the most important presence out west, because it begins to fund irrigation projects, and cities like Los Angeles wouldn't exist without them. It begins to do massive amounts of forestry to prevent forest fires, and it begins to sell its mineral rights. The biggest asset that the national government has is the land that it owns. So it pretty much stimulates settlement throughout the 19th century by selling land cheaply, selling land on credit. And during the financial panic in the early 1820s, for instance, extending that credit. We all are familiar today with the subprime loan crisis. Well, when settlers got in trouble because the value of their land crashed, what did the national government do? It extended them credit, and then it re-extended and re-extended.
And was that to protect the citizens because otherwise they'd lose their livelihood, or was it to keep our security stake and claim on territories that otherwise would...
No, it was more economic. It was more protecting their livelihoods. It was no different than the bank bailouts of today or the trickle-down loan programs of today so that people can keep their houses. It's a very long-standing tradition.
You know, you write that the 19th century government created the infrastructure that allowed America later to become the superpower it became in the 20th century. It just did it in more subtle ways than we see now.
Yeah. The most important thing that the national government did was think nationally. The most important thing it did was to consistently frame American interests in national terms rather than sectional or regional or local terms. No one thought that this union was really going to hold together. Everyone had the European model of a bunch of warring factions, warring states. How could you have a society that had slavery but also factories in the North? How could you have that hold together? Yet this vision of one nation and some common institutions like the bank, but also this developmental notion. Well, you know, maybe if we work together as a union to make the West safe for white settlers, to expand, to take advantage of these continental resources, maybe everybody can benefit. That vision, which was embodied in the national government, is really the most important thing that the national government did. Now, obviously, it didn't always work, and the Civil War is a great example of that.
Tell me also about the period that we now call the Gilded Age in the late 19th century. This is when America really industrialized.
It is. The Gilded Age comes from the term coined by Mark Twain, gilded as in covered with gold, not gilted, although many people felt these robber barons should have felt guilty. It stretched from the end of Reconstruction, 1877, through the 1890s. It was an era that we generally associate with greed, robber barons, the emergence of large corporations. Large corporations were regulated by the states, not by the national government. They emerged as citizens. It's when people stopped thinking about corporations as public entities, as performing public services, and started thinking of them as kind of natural outcroppings of the economy.
You mean there was a period when we thought of corporations as public service entities?
You bet. I mean, the earliest corporations in America are actually townships, they're churches. But a good example for the early 19th century would be a bridge. A bunch of businessmen would want to build a bridge, charge revenue, charge tolls for going over that bridge. But you don't want to build that bridge only to have somebody else build a bridge right next to you and take away your money. It's just not worth it. And it's not in the public interest to have two bridges when you only need one. So these businessmen would go to the township or the county. They'd say, look, we want a charter. We want a monopoly. We want to incorporate. And then the government would come back. This is local government, and say, you know, this would be great. We could ship so much more if we had a bridge at this particular crossing. So the town would oversee this incorporation for the public good. People did that with steamship companies that went up and down the Hudson. They did that primarily with transportation. The Supreme Court allowed these corporations to have a bundle of rights and to operate nationally when previously they had been regulated by the states, that allowed these corporations to thrive, that allowed them to aggregate the kind of profits that they did, that allowed them to become a so-called natural part of the economy. And what I'm saying is that didn't happen naturally. That happened because of some very important legal decisions by a political body, the Supreme Court of the United States.
You know, Brian, most of us think of you through the National Public Radio program Backstory, where you and Ed Ayers and Peter Onuf talk about current events sometimes with deep historical background. Before becoming an historian, you worked for a time as a welfare administrator in New York. What insights did that give you about the role of the federal government in the lives of citizens?
Yeah, I learned firsthand that good intentions and large bureaucracies don't always put the money where it is most needed. And what I've learned from being an historian, and especially this book, I hope, is that there is great common ground between what we call conservatives and liberals today, if we are willing to use a little bit of government direction, a little bit of federal funding, and work with not only state and local government, but also voluntary organizations, and progressives will kill me for this, but work through religious institutions. That this is how the national government has worked throughout American history, with a few exceptions.
Well, Brian Ballow, thank you for sharing your insights today on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
In Washington, oh Lordy, in Washington.
We've avenues and circles that lead you round and round. start out for the capital, but you end up in Georgetown.
In Washington, in Washington, in Washington, D.C., in Washington.
Brian Ballow is the 20th century historian on VFH Radio's Backstory. He's a professor of history at the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. His new book is A Government Out of Sight, The Mystery of National Authority in 19th Century America. Coming up next, the hidden welfare state.
You say you don't like our weather, you think it's kind of strange. Well, stick around 10 minutes or so, the weather is bound to change
in Washington.